After nearly a decade, energy policy is back on the agenda in Washington. The new president and vice president, both veterans of the oil industry, are urging a new national energy policy. NPR's Peter Overby reports oil has been a force in the Capitol for years.
Politics is about perceptions, and in oil politics, it boils down to two competing images. One dates back to Wall Street at the turn of the last century. The Standard Oil Trust, manipulating markets and gouging customers until it was broken up by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1906. In a campaign speech 6 years later, Roosevelt was still bragging about the punishment he'd inflicted on Standard Oil.
I administered it because I thought the Standard Oil needed it.
Compare that villainous image with this. The oil-soaked wildcatter dancing under his first gusher. James Dean captured the independence and the arrogance in the 1956 movie Giant.
My well came in big, so big, big, and there's more down there, and there's bigger whales. I'm rich, baby. I'm a rich boy.
Can you think of how many movies where you see that wildcatter in front of the derrick, you know, heroically fighting against the odds?
Economist lawyer Steve Iser authored a study of oil policy and politics.
We love this image. We love it. We have it in our movies, and we love it in our politics.
It worked in Washington, even for the majors, the big oil companies with East Coast roots. Former Louisiana Senator J. Bennett Johnston remembers wildcatters lobbying Congress.
I mean, they're a caricature of what somebody thinks of as a lobbyist. I mean, they will frequently have the boots and hat, and the cigar and the affectation of great wealth, and they would fly in their jet planes, which they'd call smokers down in parts of Texas.
Oil provided the energy that transformed 20th century America. But there have always been fears that the country would run out. Something that wildcatters and oil executives agreed on was the need to keep finding new reserves and the need for government to help. In the 1920s, oil turned to President Warren G. Harding, a man who loved to celebrate small towns.
What is the greatest thing in life? Happiness. And there is more happiness in the American village than any place on earth.
Harding loved small towns and big business. His Interior Secretary, Albert Fall, gave Sinclair Oil a sweetheart lease on a Navy oil reserve called Teapot Dome. Fall got big so-called loans in return. Historian Robert Mutch says the Republican Party got help, too, on debts left over from Harding's presidential campaign.
Some of that debt was taken care of after the campaign by the Sinclair Oil Company. These contributions never showed up until there was an inquiry into the leases that the company got.
Starting with Democrat Franklin Roosevelt's administration, the government moved to regulate the oil and gas business. But Congress was also dealing out tax breaks. In the entire tax code, it's hard to find a provision that lasted longer or stirred up more anger than the oil depletion allowance. Robert McIntyre is at Citizens for Tax Justice, a liberal think tank.
If you drilled for oil, the cost of doing it, you'd write off right away, and then you'd write off your depletion allowance, which was supposed to be a substitute for writing off the cost of drilling for oil, and you'd do it over again. So sometimes they'd write off four or five times of the cost of drilling for oil, which is why oil companies in the olden days paid hardly anything in taxes.
The depletion allowance was on the books for 60 years at 27.5%. One lawmaker admitted that they just invented the number and stuck the 0.5 on it to make it look scientific. Oil's friends were the barons of Capitol Hill. Louisiana's Russell Long wrote tax law in the Senate. Oklahoma's Robert Kerr was an oil millionaire himself. He could sweet-talk his colleagues, but he also called another senator a rancid tub of ignorance. And there was Lyndon Johnson. In 1940, young and ambitious, LBJ saw the Republicans' pipeline of oil money, and he tapped into it. Historian Robert Dalek of Boston University wrote a biography of Johnson.
He worked with Sam Rayburn, who was the Democratic Speaker of the House, to raise money for Democratic candidates across the country. And when the oil fellas exceeded the legal amount they were able to give, which I believe was $5,000, they began giving cash. And it was brought up to Washington by Lyndon Johnson in sealed envelopes.
During the Cold War, the Barons protected oil by labeling it a national security issue. Gasoline was cheap, oil's enemies were few. But in 1956, as in the 20s, the industry lost its sacred cow status in a scandal. A senator said he'd been offered $2,500 to vote for decontrol of natural gas. Steve Iser.
A bunch of oil lobbyists came up from Texas and started spreading money around and were indiscreet about it. And the irony of this is, to the press, it was like big oil flexing its muscles. It was actually little oil being indiscreet.
President Dwight Eisenhower decided he had to veto the bill. It took another 2 decades before Congress would decontrol natural gas. But by then, the wildcatter image had been nearly demolished, and so had the political clout that went with it. In 1969, an oil rig off Santa Barbara, California blew out, creating an oil slick that covered 800 square miles. 4 years later came the OPEC oil embargo. As drivers queued up in gas lines, corporate profits soared. Oil's enemies multiplied and suddenly had ammunition they'd never had before.
Do you and each of you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give before this subcommittee shall be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God?
I do.
Senator Henry Jackson, Scoop Jackson from Washington State, had White House ambitions. He used his subcommittee to put the big oil executives under oath and make them explain why gasoline prices had quadrupled. Carl Pope, director of the Sierra Club, says the government started holding oil accountable in a new way.
The oil industry could no longer simply go into a place, trash it, and leave. Somebody was looking over their shoulder. They had to meet pollution standards. They had to clean up some of the mess they left behind them. They didn't have access to every piece of public land they wanted.
And now oil was losing battles it used to win. Its old friends in Congress were gone, the victims of old age, congressional reforms, or political changes back home. But the industry was changing, too. The wildcatters themselves were disappearing. The majors, the multinationals, were making their money on imported oil. So they had a new agenda in Washington. Frank Verastro is an industry consultant.
Increasingly, as people looked overseas, then all of a sudden you were more likely to go to the government as an ally. Because things like political instability, boundaries, the lack of laws in certain countries came to be much bigger issues.
Issues that in 1991 led to war in the Persian Gulf.
We've made our stand not simply to protect resources or real estate, but to protect the freedom of nations.
The first President Bush compared Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler. Robert Dalek says that's the way America has always mixed foreign policy and energy policy.
You invoke the idealistic, you wave the flag, and you don't want to talk about oil interests. You don't want to talk about oil companies, because if you do, people see this as the special interest.
Today, oil still has a Washington wish list, from drilling on public lands to support for overseas ventures to tax breaks.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President.
And once again, it has a well-placed friend in Washington, a president who got his start as a wildcatter in West Texas. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.